All right. So, welcome to the afternoon general session to everyone. As I said before, we will have a very lively session this afternoon. I'm looking forward to it. But before we start, I want to kick it off with a door prize.
Door prize.
All right.
We have four $25 prizes.
Okay.
Our first name is Jenna Dupree.
Jenna Dupree, are you here? If you're here, raise your hand. Okay. Go to the next one.
Jocelyn Webb Burden.
Borden. Okay, now she is a parent, so we will have to check and see if she's in the parent session, and I will do that because that's going on simultaneously to this one, so I will check and get back to you on that one later on. Okay. Next.
Maria Sanders.
Maria Sanders, I saw her name, so I'm just waiting for her to raise her hand. Maria, you were here.
Star nine.
Or she actually was... yeah, star nine, because she I don't know if she was using her phone or what she's doing. Star nine, if you're on the phone, Maria. Okay, do you got a, do you have another one?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have another one?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, Maria, I think looks like she has her hand up already. I didn't see it go up, but it is. Let me look. Yep, she has her hand raised already.
Okay. Mary Jo Zeiler?
Mary Jo Zeiler? Okay. Okay.
Do I need to redraw?
Denise left for a second, or at least she turned off her video and muted.
Okay, I think I was unmuted. What I was going to say is those people, some folks are not responding, so except for Maria Sanders. So we will try it again later on, and we will start with the diversity and inclusion meeting this afternoon. The person that's here to facilitate the discussion is Sean Colloway, who is an NFB Board of Directors member and also co-chair, along with Rosie Carranza, of our diversity and inclusion committee. And he and the co-chairs of the NFBI Diversity Committee, Marilyn Green and Sarah Luna, are also here to facilitate this discussion. So I will turn it over to Sean and Marilyn, and then I will make Sarah a co-host.
Thank you, Madam President. Thank you, everyone, for being here this afternoon. We hope that you enjoyed our pre-convention item last week, and you are here to get some more information about how the National Federation of the Blind of Illinois wants to make our affiliate more diverse and inclusive of all people who are blind. Sean Calloway is here. My co-chair, Sarah Luna, is being made a co-host, and she can introduce herself later. Many of you know me from doing federal legislation for our affiliate. Sean Calloway, if you would introduce yourself, please.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Sean Calloway. I am president of the National Federation of the Blind of the District of Columbia, and as Denise stated, I serve on the board of National Board of Directors, and I'm also co-chair of the Diversity and Inclusion Committee, as well as chair of our Black Leaders Serving for Advancement. So I'm certainly happy to be here within this wonderful affiliate, and looking forward to this discussion.
All right. Thank you, Sean, for introducing yourself. It looks like Sarah is now a co-host. Sarah, if you would introduce yourself as well. Sarah, are you there?
I gotta say, yes, I was trying to find the unmute button. I found it. Mm-hmm. Hello, everyone. I'm Sarah Luna, one of your Diversity and Inclusion Committee co-chairs. I'm really glad to have all of you here. I also serve as a co-chair of the NABS Diversity and Inclusion Committee. I was a 2020 National Scholarship recipient, and I'm really glad to have all of you here.
Okay, so a little bit of information about how we will do this session this afternoon. There will be a thought provoker. And we will have about 20 minutes for that. There's going to be a TED Talk video called The Danger of the Single Story. And it's an African author. I forget what country she is from, but she has written various fiction books. Her name is Chimamanda Ngozi, I believe is the pronunciation. We're going to play about 5 minutes of that, and then Sean will lead that for us. And then after that, we will have three great presenters who will speak about their lived experiences as with the intersection of blindness and their diverse identities. And then at the end, we will have time for Q&A. So please hold your questions till the end. If you want to raise your hand during, just please understand that you will not be acknowledged until the end after the presenters for the thought provoker. There will be time for people to comment on what they thought about the presentation. Do we have the video ready?
And yes, Sean, we do. Ready?
Okay, great.
I'm ready.
All right, thank you.
I'm a storyteller, and I would like to tell you a few personal stories about what I like to call the danger of the single story. I grew up on a university campus in eastern Nigeria. My mother says that I started reading at the age of 2, although I think 4 is probably close to the truth. So I was an early reader, and what I read were British and American children's books. I was also an early writer. And when I began to write at about the age of 7, stories in pencil with crayon illustrations that my poor mother was obligated to read, I wrote exactly the kinds of stories I was reading. All my characters were white and blue-eyed. They played in the snow. They ate apples. And they talked a lot about the weather, how lovely it was that the sun had come out. Now, this despite the fact that I lived in Nigeria, had never been outside Nigeria. We didn't have snow, we ate mangoes, and we never talked about the weather because there was no need to. My characters also drank a lot of ginger beer because the characters in the British books I read drank ginger beer. Never mind that I had no idea what ginger beer was. And for many years afterwards, I would have a desperate desire to taste ginger beer. But that is another story. What this demonstrates, I think, is how impressionable and vulnerable we are in the face of a story, particularly as children. Because all I had read were books in which characters were foreign, I had become convinced that books, by their very nature, had to have foreigners in them and had to be about things with which I could not personally identify. Now, things changed when I discovered African books. There weren't many of them available, and they weren't quite as easy to find as the foreign books, but because of writers like Chinua Achebe and Kamara Laye, I went through a mental shift in my perception of literature. I realized that people like me, girls with skin the color of chocolate, whose kinky hair could not form ponytails, could also exist in literature. I started to write about things I recognized. Now, I loved those American and British books I read. They stirred my imagination, they opened up new worlds for me. But the unintended consequence was that I did not know that people like me could exist in literature. So what the discovery of African writers did for me was this: it saved me from having a single story of what books are. I come from a conventional middle-class Nigerian family. My father was a professor, my mother was an administrator. And so we had, as was the norm, living domestic help who would often come from nearby rural villages. So the year I turned 8, we got a new houseboy. His name was Fide. The only thing my mother told us about him was that his family was very poor. My mother sent yams and rice and our old clothes to his family. And when I didn't finish my dinner, my mother would say, "Finish your food. Don't you know people like Fide's family have nothing?" So I felt enormous pity for Fide's family. Then one Saturday, we went to his village to visit. And his mother showed us a beautifully patterned basket made of dyed raffia that his brother had made. I was startled. It had not occurred to me that anybody in his family could actually make something. All I had heard about them was how poor they were, so that it had become impossible for me to see them as anything else but poor. Their poverty was my single story of them. Years later, I thought about this when I left Nigeria to go to university in the United States. I was 19. My American roommate was shocked by me. She asked where I had learned to speak English so well and was confused when I said that Nigeria happened to have English as its official language. She asked if she could listen to what she called my tribal music, and was consequently very disappointed when I produced my tape of Mariah Carey. She assumed that I did not know how to use a stove. What struck me was this: she had felt sorry for me even before she saw me. Her default position toward me as an African was a kind of patronizing, well-meaning pity. My roommate had a single story of Africa, a single story of catastrophe. In this single story, there was no possibility of Africans being similar to her in any way, no possibility of feelings more complex than pity, no possibility of a connection as human equals.
All right. Wonderful. Boy, that was a very interesting piece there. And so we're here to have a discussion on what was just played on that audio video, what have you. In that 5-minute audio for me, there was so much that jumped out in regards to sort of the correlation on why diversity and inclusion is needed within the organizations. Is not even funny, quite honestly. So we have a lot of hands, lower the hands. But I guess we're going to begin, Marilyn, because there are no list of questions. I'll be just moderating based on the video, correct? Marilyn? Okay. Well, let me go ahead and start.
That's correct, Sean. Sorry.
Okay. That's correct. Okay. No problem. Now, okay, got you. Okay. So, based on this particular video that you just witnessed here, and like I said, myself, I can just dig out a few things, but I want to see what those of you, what you think. Can you name one sort of item within that video that you can relate to as a member of the Federation where the term assumption was used by this woman in regards to sort of her lifestyle, right? Can anyone give me an example of assumptions made by someone based on your, not only your blindness, but your background, your diverse background? And I see quite a few, some raised hands here. Got three raised hands, so.
Okay. I forgot you could see the raised.
Yeah, so. Sabrina?
We're sending things to so people can unmute them.
I'm unmuted.
Okay.
Ellen, I would like to speak at some point since I cannot raise my hand.
I actually jumped the gun because I was going to respond in a completely different way.
Okay. All right. So let's get to...
So your question again...
Hold on.
Your question again was assumptions made.
So, sir, hold on, sir.
Your question again was assumptions.
Hold on for 1 second. No. I want to make sure Sabrina.
No. This is Sabrina.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, this Sabrina. Okay, Sabrina. This sounds like a man, but. Pronoun she said her.
I don't see.
And I jumped the gun on the question. I thought you were going a different direction. So I was clarified that. The question was.
Sabrina, you kind of going in and out. Can you hear us?
Sean, this is Ellen. Can I answer the question since I can't raise my hand?
Sure, go ahead.
So what I kind of got from the video was when I kind of relate this more to my blindness, more than ethnicity, but when she was talking about how her roommate thought that she couldn't cook or use a stove or anything, mm-hmm. I always think of that as a stereotype of blind people that we can't do anything for ourselves, that we expect to rely on other people.
Yes, yes.
Sean, Janice unmuted now, so she can.
Okay, Janice.
Hi. I can definitely relate to this. When I was in college, and I was put in a group for a group project, my group gave me what my jobs were to do, and as I studied and got my research and wrote out not only my parts, but parts of theirs, they then went to the teacher and told them I wasn't doing my part. And another classmate that wasn't in our group saw me in the library working for hours and hours doing not only my part, but their part because they didn't come and do it. And stuck up for the teacher and told them that they were lying, that I had spent hours upon hours there, and that they were singling me out because I was the only different person in the class. Mm. Not only because I was blind, they said there was no way I could do it because I was blind, and because ethnically, I was the only African American in the teacher program, actually at Weston. at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So the teacher talked to other students and the librarian and learned that I had spent hours upon hours there and took the whole entire project away from the group and gave them a new project and said that I would be my own group in charge of that entire project because I had been doing it anyway and gave them their entire own project. And she told me not to be upset because she had found out I'd been doing it anyway. But I can definitely relate and understand what that young lady was feeling.
Mm-hmm.
It happens more and more than you ever realize.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that, Janice. Sabrina raised her hand again, Pam, or you have someone else?
Okay, we're coming back to you, Sabrina. Debbie?
Okay. Debbie?
Hi. Pittman? I can relate to that very well because I was in a situation where, unfortunately, an NFB person told somebody a story about me, which was a lie, and the person didn't come to me and talk to me to find out what was really going on. And they took what the person said and took it to heart and basically didn't communicate with me, but only through their actions and apparently sharing this with other people did I find out that it really stemmed from the lie that had taken place some time before. So it's very important that people get more than just one side of a story. Because it can be very harmful. And we have to not do that in the organization. We have to give everybody an opportunity to give their side.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, Debbie.
Sabrina should be.
Yeah. I think she's there.
Sabrina, if you can unmute yourself, I sent you an invitation.
Okay.
There you go.
Hey, can y'all hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So first of all, pronouns are she/her. I am an anatomical male, but she/her. And secondly, I'm going to kind of give the other side of things as far as making assumptions and how that can take away from progress. So as people have heard from the NFB, we always hear that the NFB is militant and the NFB this, that, and the other. And I, at different times, have believed that. So I always never really saw a reason to join the NFB, even though I had friends over the last couple of years who, I don't know. Wow.
Sabrina, we got about a good 30 or 40 seconds, Sabrina.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you, Sabrina.
All right. So just to wrap it up quickly, Independence Day this year, I was wondering if I could go to the NFB National Convention. And on our way to seeing if I could, even if I wasn't registered, that's when I found that the Pride and Love from Pride Month. And that's when I realized that my assumptions were wrong about the NFB, and I am glad that I have been a part of the NFB for the last 8 months. And I'm going to mute because Zoom doesn't like me. So I hope I've made sense, and I will let y'all continue.
Thanks, sir. And Maurice?
And Maurice will be the last one for this particular question.
She if you can unmute yourself, Maurice.
Star six.
Okay.
There you
are. This is lady, and she assumed that because I was blind that I couldn't tell what color she was, you know. And she, by me being black and she was white, and I had to explain to her that even though I was blind, I knew by the sound of her voice that I could tell what color she was, and that, you know, she shouldn't make that assumption, you know, just because I'm blind, I'm not aware of what's going on around me.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate that, Maurice. And I'm gonna just move on to the next question real quick. I want to say this before we move on. Sabrina is a situation where the reason why we use pronouns, right? I made the assumption because I did not see her pronouns, right? Just based on her voice, I thought it was a sound of a man, right? But her pronouns is there, big as day, and I missed them, and that's why these pronouns are extremely important, right? And that's why pronouns are used for inclusivity. So that's just a example of assumptions that are made oftentimes that hamper us as individuals from diverse backgrounds. So I appreciate your comments from that question. We're going to move on to the next question. Based on the audio, now one of the things the woman mentioned in the audio is that she grew up, right, reading American and British literature. And reading American and British literature, she did not know anything else outside of that, right? So, for example, when you come into the Federation over the past few years, you knew blindness, right? But maybe there were some other things you missed outside of blindness. So did anyone relate to the presenter in stating that all she knew was American and British literature, but to her surprise, there were other writers who were like her, right? That she did not know anything about because she was so stuck into American and British literature. But does anyone have that sort of correlated feeling that this woman had in regards to your blindness? There's a raised hand, Pam, I think.
Okay. Well, yeah, Elizabeth. So you can unmute. There you go. Elizabeth.
Uh-oh.
I'm not sure what happened to, okay.
She has raised her hand again.
There you go. Okay. So I just sent you an to unmute, Elizabeth. So there you go. You should be able to unmute now.
And Sean, while Elizabeth is unmuting,
sure.
Close to our end time, so maybe after Elizabeth, there's maybe one more comment.
Yes, that's no problem.
Move on. Okay, thank
okay,
you.
Okay, got you. Okay.
Okay, Elizabeth. You can try again to unmute yourself. I'm sending the invitation to invite you to do so. So hopefully you're getting it.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question again? Because we were trying to unmute and...
Well, basically the question really surrounds commonality, right? The woman had mentioned how all her life she was reading American and British literature, and she never knew that there were literary artists like herself until she, I guess, went outside of the American British sort of aspect and found that there were literary artists and who were Nigerian as well. So based on that sort of her action, which is a sense of commonality. Have you had that feeling as a blind person?
Yes, I have.
Yes, go ahead.
So I've had that experience a lot in my in one of the schools that I what I think it was, yeah, it was my elementary school. And I had that experience a lot. And that because I was next to another person, I was compared to that other person. And whatever limit that people saw kind of was like, oh, everyone has that limit. And and then I was also very overprotected as well. Also because I was the blind person with other blind children who were also very overprotected. And I didn't really know that, I didn't really fully understand that there were a lot of other, you know, blind students or students who were blind like me. And until maybe middle school and when I met other people and like through like Freedom Link, for example, and that's where I really got to know a lot of other blind people through the NFB.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thank you for that. And we had time for one more comment. David, I believe.
You should be on the unmute, Dave.
Dave?
If you can unmute yourself, Dave.
Dave? Unmute yourself, Dave.
There you go.
Oh, Dave, finally. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
I had an experience a number of years ago, and I guess this came to a kind of a overall perception about what blind people were kind of expected to do. I was actually in a hospital. My previous wife had had a couple of major eye surgeries, one of them being a corneal surgery. And back in the 90s, there were a lot of lifting restrictions over the first few weeks of recovery. And we were talking about, you know, the general procedures and stuff like that. And I mentioned to the physician, I said, it's my understanding that she has lifting restrictions, so I'm not home for a good part of the day. Should I actually get whatever utensils she's going to need if she wants to actually cook something or prepare something and make sure they're on the stove before I leave? And the question I was hit with was, well, you don't work a job, do you?
Wow. We're gonna wrap this up on this part of the program, but I will say this. If you look at with a lot of these comments that were made, and if you look at that film, there were two things that stuck out: assumptions and commonality, right? Oftentimes, again, assumptions preclude us from really gaining progress within any organization. Right. We can't assume anything about anyone, number one, unless you ask. You got to ask folks. And making sort of the taking that element away, the element of assumption away, that's when you sort of create those inclusive spaces. Secondly, commonality. Commonality is extremely important. This is why diversity and inclusion has been put in place in a sense. So there will be other individuals you can connect with based on your diverse background. Elizabeth just mentioned her life seemed to be so much better when she was able to connect with other blind people. That's called commonality. So I hope you really enjoyed that video. And my suggestion, Madam Chairs, if you will kind of extend this discussion later on in the year with additional time, because I think it's a discussion that really needs to be had within the affiliate. So thank you for that.
Madam Chairs, can I give out two more door prizes or not?
If we could please wait till the end, because we're running a little past time. So if you want to do door prizes at the end of this presentation, that'd be great.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. So we had, thank you, Sean, so much. Thank you to everyone for your comments. We thought that it was a great presentation, and you can definitely go online and Google search. It's a TED Talk, The Danger of the Single Story. And we definitely, Sarah and I definitely have discussed how we can incorporate the entire video and having a conversation about it within the affiliate. So with all of that being said, we have three great presenters for you all this afternoon. Two of our very own right here from Illinois. We have Natalie Shaheen. We have Sarah Luna, who's co-chair of diversity and inclusion. And we have Everly Hairston from California. I apologize to the presenters that we didn't give you any order of presenters. But Natalie, if you are able to stop, and then we could go to Everly and then end with Sarah. If that does not sound like a good idea, I can change it.
That sounds fine to me, Marilyn. I'm ready when you are.
All right. Thank you so much.
And since we are behind, do you want, how much time you want to give each of us?
I think we agreed to 10 minutes. I think if you all could maybe cut it down to maybe 7 or 8 minutes, and then that way we should still have enough time for about 10 minutes of Q&A at the end of your session, at the end of the presentations. So if that works for everyone, that would be great, because I think that all of you have great things to say about your intersection of blindness and diverse identities, and we definitely want people to have time to communicate with you all about that. And if we don't have time at the end, we can always incorporate that into another diversity and inclusion program. We could incorporate it into, you know, distributing your email or contact information at some point, or even having you on later to present at one of our committee meetings. So with all of that being said, and just one more housekeeping note that I did not make at the beginning, please, we have, I think it's over 50 or 60 people. If each person could just wait at least one time before they want to speak again, we do want to have a diverse community of people who are speaking during this conversation as well. Okay. Natalie, if you are ready, you have the floor.
I am ready. So luckily I speak fast, so that's good. I'll try to be fast. So hopefully y'all can listen fast. You're good with JAWS and all that jazz and you're used to that. So first, a disclaimer. I have a 16-pound Boston Terrier sitting at my feet who is snoring like a freight train. So if you hear any snoring, know that it is not my wife, Bridget. It is the dog, despite the fact that the dog sounds like a very large man snoring. It is a small dog. So just that, a quick visual description of myself. I am a fair-skinned white woman with short, dark blonde hair that is curly on top. I have in the background a picture of Glacier National Park, so some very pretty mountains, and I am wearing a tweed blazer trying to go for that quirky professor look. Y'all have to tell me if I succeeded. So we all know that blindness is not a monolithic experience. That is to say that we each experience blindness in a different way. Our experiences are mediated by our intersectional identities and the privilege and oppression that accompany those identities. So my experience of blindness is mediated by my identity as a white, upper middle class, queer, cisgender woman of Arab ethnicity. So there's a word in there that might be new to some of you, so I want to make sure that I define it for you. So cisgender means that the gender with which I identify, female, matches the sex I was assigned at birth. My intersectional identity comes with substantial privilege in our culture. So much privilege that despite several years of reading and deep reflection, I still don't understand the depth of my privilege. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that privilege at the end here of my remarks. My intersectional identity also comes with some oppression in our culture. Like the vast majority of you, I face oppression as a blind person. I also face oppression as a queer Arab woman. So in reflecting on my lived experience to prepare for today's conversation, it occurred to me that one good exemplar of my intersectional experience of oppression is the way in which I perform my gender and my class. What does that mean, the way I perform my gender and my class? So there are certain ways in which women are expected to behave in our society. There are certain ways we're supposed to look. Similarly, at least in the microculture in which I was raised, there are certain ways that upper middle class white people are supposed to behave and look. this is what I'm talking about when I say performance. So I've been oppressed in my life because I have never performed my gender or my class according to social norms. When I was a kid, and I mean, to a large extent today, girls were supposed to wear dresses. They're supposed to wear cute little white, pink, and pink patent leather shoes with flowers and bedazzle on them, play with Barbies, and be dainty and graceful. I am none of those things. And upper middle class white girls were supposed to enjoy getting dressed up anytime they went out in public, whether that was to the mall, to the country club, to the grocery store, or a play date. And getting dressed up meant wearing cute, coordinated outfits, doing your hair, and putting on a full face of makeup. And upper middle class white kids were supposed to hang out with other upper middle class white kids and grow up to take on careers where they would make lots of money. Well, these rules of performance never really made any sense to me. Though I was trained to perform according to those rules, it never felt natural. As I grew up, I oscillated between begrudgingly acquiescing to these rules and actively rebelling against them. I don't like wearing dresses or skirts, and I flat out refused to wear them from the age of 2 to 16. I once told my mother that if she was going to enroll me in Catholic school, she would have to enroll me as a boy because I was not wearing a skirt to school. The clothing that felt natural to me were pants, boys' sneakers, because in my day, girls' sneakers were boring, white and pink, and they were just yucky. A big t-shirt and a ball cap. I didn't like fussing with my hair. For most of my childhood, I had short hair, which of course went against the performance rules. And to top it off, I have curly hair, which also was against the rules of performance. You see, little girls, especially little white girls, are supposed to have long, straight, shiny hair. But I got a strong dose of the Shaheen Arab genes, and I have curly hair, which I was, instead of being told to embrace my curly hair, I was encouraged to straighten it. So as a gender non-conforming queer Arab woman growing up, I learned that if I wanted to be acknowledged and praised, I needed to grow my hair out, straighten it, wear dresses, heels, and a full face of makeup. That message came across very clear because where I grew up, perhaps the only thing more important than your image was how much money you made. But I also rejected that whole money business. As a kid, my favorite Bible verse was the one about money being the root of all evil. By the end of elementary school, I was so tired of the homogeny of my neighborhood and being the only weird kid who didn't perform according to the norm that I actively sought out people in middle school who grew up in other neighborhoods who weren't white and who were disabled. I was friends with all the other kids who didn't fit in because they weren't upper middle class white, able, heterosexual, cisgender people. And as if that was not enough acting out of turn, I decided to grow up to be a teacher, a profession where, as I'm sure you know, I was never going to make big bucks. For many years, and in some ways still today, I felt bad about not performing my gender and class according to societal expectations to try to make up for not following the rules about career choice. For many years, I acquiesced to the rules about appearance when I was in the public eye. In professional settings, I donned a costume that fit the rules. I wore dresses and skirts, pointy-toed stilettos, a full face of makeup, and I wore my long hair straightened and down. But the moment I got home, I took off the costume and put on clothes that felt more natural. The difference between these two appearances were so stark that my weightlifting teammates didn't recognize me when I had on my public costume. Feeling like you have to wear a costume to be accepted is oppressing and can deeply impact someone's sense of self. As I mentioned earlier, while I have faced oppression in my life, I have also benefited tremendously from privilege. Nowhere has this privilege been more evident than in school. In the past, when I've told my story, I've failed to acknowledge and name that privilege. And I'd like to kind of write that today, if y'all don't mind. When I've told my story before, it's gone something like this. When I was an infant, the doctors told my parents I was legally blind and that I would never learn to read or write, graduate from high school, or go to college. The school system and the doctors were in cahoots for many years. You see, despite the fact that I was congenitally blind, I didn't receive special education services until I was in sixth grade, and I never had a teacher of blind students. But I worked really hard, and I graduated from high school, undergraduate, and graduate school with honors, and now I'm a professor. Yay me! In this version of my story, there's no... My wife is laughing in the background. It's almost like having a real audience. In this version of my story, there's no discussion about the fact that I grew up in an upper middle class household with college educated parents, that I'm white, that my father was an attorney, that our neighbor was the president of the school board. Because of my family's socioeconomic status and race, people at the school saw and listened to us, a privilege that my middle school friends didn't have. because I was an upper middle class kid, I already knew how to behave according to the middle class behavioral norms that schools demand, a privilege that working class kids don't have. Unlike my friend Selwyn, I was not harassed by my fourth grade teacher for being the only Black child in our school. Because my parents had disposable income, they hired numerous tutors to help me develop literacy skills, something the school failed to do, and to help me continue to build my math skills because math class at school was too easy for me. After years of me struggling in elementary school, my parents not making progress through polite conversations with the school, my father sent a letter to the superintendent. Why did the superintendent respond so quickly? Perhaps the fact that my father signed the letter, Arnold E. Shaheen Jr., attorney at law, had an influence. Or perhaps the fact that he mentioned our good friend who was the president of the school board. Or maybe it was the fact that he reminded the superintendent that he was a taxpayer who could choose not to vote for the next funding request from the school board. Maybe that was what did the trick. Probably it was all of those things. So my story is a lot about the ways in which privilege, particularly class and race privilege, mitigate the effects of disability-related oppression. And it's a little bit about working hard. That's not to say that as an upper middle class white blind person, I have not faced oppression. I have, I talked about that. But I realized today that telling my story in a way that obscures my privilege does harm. It does harm to blind people who don't share that privilege. Because my story, the way I have told it in the past, sends this message. If you work hard enough, you can get where I've gotten. And even worse, it sends a message I never intended, which is, if you aren't where I am, it's because you haven't worked hard enough. You have no one to blame but yourself. And that's not true. As we think about diversity and inclusion in the Federation, I think it's important that we learn about the ways in which many of our members experience oppression related to their intersectional identities. It is also critical that we take time to reflect on the privilege that we have, particularly those of us who are white and middle class. In closing, I think it's worth noting that my younger sister and other peers that I grew up with would likely characterize their experience growing up different than I have here, because their experience, like mine, is mediated by their intersectional identity. My sister is a sighted, heterosexual, cisgender woman who shares my Arab ethnicity but has naturally straight hair. My sister easily performed her gender in class according to the rules, unlike me, so her experience was different. That's what I've got.
Thank you so much, Natalie. I always, when I hear you speak, I always remember that you are a professor. You have an immense vocabulary. And now we will move on to Everly Hairston.
And good afternoon, everyone. I am Everly Hairston, a member of the National Board of Directors of the National Federation of the Blind. I am an author. The title of my book, Blind Ambition, One Woman's Journey to Greatness Despite Her Blindness. Well, my long and extraordinary journey with diversity and inclusion includes, number one, growing up in the segregated South. So there I experienced difficulty in education, not only education, but employment, not only employment, housing, and the latter, which is organizations. I want to start off by sharing with you some of what I experienced growing up in the segregated South. I attended segregated schools from grades K through 12, after which I attended an all-Black college. But while in college, I had an opportunity to fight for my civil rights as an African-American female. And that was under the leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., protesting Sears and Roebuck's company because of their refusal to hire Blacks. Well, after college, I thought that I would have wonderful and great opportunities because I moved to New Jersey. Well, I graduated in February and needed to wait until the next school term in order to begin my teaching career. But I needed employment in order to be able to pay the bills. I went to the Bank of New Jersey and applied for a position. I was met with, "Thank you for calling and contacting us. You sounded so wonderful over the phone. I am so sorry to tell you, however, that we have not begun to hire Blacks in this bank." I was devastated, but not going to be defeated. As my journey continued, it was then that I found my place as a teacher in the state of New Jersey. No real problems there, except that that's when I experienced some of the symptoms of retinitis pigmentosa. I had night blindness, and I was finding it more and more difficult to read or to see, even in daylight. One day, I was writing some shorthand forms on the blackboard. And because of the stress and trying to keep up, not being able to see, I passed out. I was rushed to the hospital, and immediately I was asked, "Are you on drugs?" I wasn't on drugs. I just couldn't see. Well, from there, and after working several years and realizing that it was too difficult as a blind person to compete with my colleagues, I'd heard about the National Federation of the Blind, learned about the NFB centers, was able to get to the Louisiana Center for the Blind, where I was able to get the training necessary to compete with my colleagues. And after returning from Louisiana and ringing that great bell, I was able to integrate all of my skills into both my personal and professional life. Moved up the ladder, surely. And that was so invigorating for me. Well, after being there for several years, I wanted to find better housing, purchase a home. I had a girlfriend who was encouraging me. She happened to be Caucasian. So one day, I went to the manager's office and inquired about purchasing a home. I was met with a lot of frustration because the manager said to me, "Well, I don't know if you'll be able to afford this house. I don't know if you realize the documents that you need. I don't realize, perhaps you don't realize that what you need today is to give us a deposit to show us in good faith that you are willing to purchase this home." I wrote a check, but I knew and believed that before that evening was over, I would be able to deposit what I needed in the bank to cover that check. That's called having faith. Well, just to show you the difference, my girlfriend decided to go to the same management office and apply for a home. She was not asked. to supply those documents. She was not even asked to write a check as a deposit to show good faith. I moved on then after purchasing that home and getting more involved in the National Federation of the Blind. I was elected as a member of the National Board of Directors, thinking that as a Black blind female, that most of my discrimination was over. But instead, as a national representative, representing our president, Mark Riccobono, representing our president, Mark Maurer, representing our organization at an affiliate state convention. Well, when I arrived in this particular state, and I normally would travel on a Thursday, soon after arriving, I received a text message from the president. I was excited. I had never met the president before. And in addition, I had never traveled to this particular state. So I was excited. I tied it up after getting to my room, went to the elevator, and there I heard a couple of people walking up using their canes. But it was a third person that I couldn't hear because they didn't have a cane. So me being so excited and always enthusiastic, I said, good evening. I'd heard them speaking to each other. Good evening, ladies. I heard nothing. So I repeated, good evening, ladies. I heard nothing. So I said, perhaps they are deaf. Well, the elevator finally stopped on the floor. I got onto the elevator and asked, are you coming on? One lady then said, we're not getting on the elevator with you, nigger. I had to stop and think about how I was going to handle this situation. I first thought, I will not stoop to this person's level. I am here to perform a task. And being here means that I'm not just representing myself as an attendee at this convention. I am representing all blind people. I went and met this state president. And believe it or not, those persons that were on the elevator walked up behind me, and I could tell from the voice that they were the ones who were now probably extremely shocked to be introduced to the national representative. Well, I want you to know that it is extremely important for us to communicate, because we never know the persons that we might meet, how these persons might be able to make change, to make a difference in an organization. You know, our president, Mark Riccobono, has written a diversity statement where he states that we embrace full participation in diversity as core values and our mission to achieve equality, opportunity, and security for the blind. I believe that. And I hope you do too. As I continue to represent our organization. I realize that organizations are extremely complex. And we are going to be introduced, and we must deal with different cultures and dynamics as the common goal of diversity and inclusion is widespread. So it is extremely important to have the daunting task of trying to figure out what works today and what will work tomorrow. So I commend you for getting leaders involved. It is extremely important to do that. We know that there are unconscious biases, and so we need to explore those unconscious biases so that we can continue to make the changes necessary in the National Federation of the Blind. One of my most important and dynamic poets is Maya Angelou. And when I spoke at the Lincoln Memorial in 2009 to the students, I was reminded of 1963 when I attended the March on Washington when Dr. Martin Luther King spoke and Maya Angelou gave and recited her famous poem. And I would like to end with that today because it sums up part of my journey and what I have had to endure. Some of the defeats I've had to endure, but I tell you, I may have had to endure the defeats, but believe me, I will never be defeated. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Because I walk like I got all wells popping in my living room, just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high. Still, I rise. Did you want to see me broken, bowed head, lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? Does my haughtiness upset you? Don't. You. Don't you be so hurt, 'cause I laugh like I got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the hits history of shame, I rise. Up from a past rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping in wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide, leaving behind the nights of terror and fear into a daybreak wondrously clear, bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise, I rise, I rise. Thank you.
Thank you, Everly. Thank you to Natalie and all our presenters. Unfortunately, we have run past our time, and I believe that our next presenter is here. So if there are questions that people have, you can send them to myself and or our co-chair, Sarah Luna. Sarah's email address is soul.sky.luna@gmail.com. My email address is marilynvgreen@gmail.com. You should have received a pre-convention email that does have the email addresses for Sarah and myself. Please reach out to us at any time if you want to know more about diversity and inclusion and want to get involved and have more conversations like these. We hope that our intention is to have more conversations like this throughout our affiliate and throughout the year. Thank you so much.
Four pads. All right. We have room for two prizes. And oh, by the way, Ellen, first of all, let me remind people, please do not send things in the chat. If there's something that you would like to say to me, you can text me or you can email me, but we would like you to avoid sending things in the chat. Ellen, the two names that you drew earlier were not in the parent session. So I will go ahead and draw two door prizes because our next speaker is here.
Eileen Tresky, $25.
Okay, I know Eileen is here. Eileen? She did raise her hand. Okay. Draw another name.
Robert Gardner.
Bob Gardner. I don't know if Bob is here. Bob Gardner. Well, he doesn't seem to be here.
Ronza M. Offman.
Ronza Offman. No, that person that's not Ronza. Draw again.
Janet Smith.
Huh?
Janet Slick.
She's not here yet, so.
Jenna Dupree,
are you here? If you can raise your hand. Nope, Jenna is not here.
Zilrak.
Say who?
A-Y-O-U-B.
Oh, Ayub. Zilrak.
Ayub.
He has raised his hand. So we have our winner. All right.